I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight. I hope you enjoyed the music and the comedy, a little bit of a flashback to Charlie Hill and much, much more. I hope you're staying safe out there. You can find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio. You can also email music, digital events, press releases, and more to pdxnativeradio@gmail.com. As always, we are so glad to still be able to provide music and much more for you listeners out there all across Turtle Island. It is always great to be able to reach out, and hopefully we are bringing a bit of home, a bit of community to you in these difficult times. As always, please stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hey there, KBOO listeners. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi, host of the new show, Radical Romance. Radical Romance is an advice show for folks who are in non-traditional relationships. Either you're in an open relationship or a polyamorous one, this is the show for you. Please call in. It airs every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 10 a.m. Look forward to hearing from you. That's Radical Romance on KBOO Community Radio.
Hello, I don't even know your name, but I'm hoping all the same, this is more than just a simple...
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. A few weeks ago, a lot of people became very upset with the corporation, the retail outlet Target, who announced pretty boldly and widely that they would be rescinding any diversity in equity and inclusion initiatives. We saw that this store that kind of had garnered a reputation for displaying different types of or celebrating different ethnicities and different months that had themes that centered around underrepresented populations, Women's History Month, Hispanic History Month, Black History Month, all those things were going to go to the wayside. And that caused a lot of uproar. There were some folks who added to the controversy because they were black or brown and had fought long and hard to get their products into Target, and they were kind of saying, don't boycott them because it's going to hurt us. Other people were saying, enough's enough. Let's go really in on Target. And so as we are in the middle of Black History Month, there are a lot of people who have really pointed out that there will be no shopping at Target. Many of us who are on social media were bombarded with the feeds, but one day I got a feed from a gentleman, a freelance journalist, and he brought attention to Target and really unearthed some facts that many of us did not know. He had authored a 12-part series about the Target Corporation called The 21st Century, Jim Crow and the North Star City. A lot of it was penned several years ago, right around the George Floyd uprising, but I would encourage people to really take a look at that report. It can be found in Unicorn Riot. So joining us this afternoon to break down what is going on with Target on a much deeper level is Minneapolis school teacher and freelance journalist, Majan MJ Sidar. I wish I could have seen the look on your face when people came out and said, we need to boycott Target. Knowing all the information that you had and a lot of what I've read, I was like, wow, I don't know if you were waiting for this moment, if you were surprised, or you were just like, if you think the store is bad, wait until you hear this information. So I'll start off with that, and then we can get into what Target has really been about.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's an honor, Davey D. And I would say the latter part. You know, when I heard that people were starting to boycott Target and the tide was finally starting to turn, my initial reaction was, wait until you hear, you know, what I got to tell you. And so a friend of mine, Aaron Johnson, he's a local Minneapolis activist and documentarian, hit me up and he wanted to interview me outside of Target's East Lake Street store, which is the famous store that was looted after the police precinct was burnt down across the street after George Floyd's murder. And so Aaron, you know, he's followed my work at Unicorn Riot, my 12-part series, and he wanted me to really go to break down, you know, what Target has really been doing and a lot of the harm they've caused our communities over the decades. And so I thought it was a perfect opportunity to let people know that Target deserves more scrutiny.
So one of the things that stood out, and I guess you cover this, I mean, throughout the 12-part series, but you jump knee deep into this in the first two. And of course, your initial report that I saw online, the updated one where you did the interviews, what caught my attention was the surveillance that Target participates in, the facial recognition. And for people that are listening and saying, well, we're in the Bay Area, what does Minneapolis have to do with us? What I garnered and what concerned me was that Target is a template that has already been followed or being uploaded by people and corporations all around the country. More concerning is this private, public type of interaction that Target has. So I guess just to kind of sum it up, if the police find their hands tied, they don't have to worry. They have Target. Target can do all the dirty work. And I think we kind of see that now with what is happening with Elon Musk and other folks who coming from the private sector and been able to use their vast private sector to do basically public work that is out of reach for most of us to contain or to scrutinize or to hold accountable. That's what I garnered from a lot of what I've read. But I'll let you take the floor. Maybe you can start breaking down and starting with the mass surveillance that Target participates in.
Yes. You know, so government resources are limited, right? So government for decades has tapped the private sector to fill in a lot of gaps. And so, like you had mentioned, law enforcement has been, they've been going to Target for more than two decades now. So in 2000 and around 2003, Target built two state-of-the-art crime labs. And I'm talking about world-class crime labs, one here in the Twin Cities and another one in Las Vegas. And Target has opened up their crime labs to law enforcement to access for free. So we're not just talking about local police, we're talking about the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, Department of Homeland Security, ICE, and so Target's crime lab.
Let me ask you this, MJ. They built a crime lab for Target, or they built a crime lab for local police department?
Well, for both. Initially, it was for Target, but through my research, what I realized is, you know, it was to help bolster its loss prevention program, catch shoplifters. But in order to do that, they target needed assistance from law enforcement, right? And so local police here in Minneapolis and throughout metropolitans across the country, they're not focused on petty shoplifting, right? So target, in order to get the police's assistance, they had to offer something, right? So target built this state-of-the-art crime lab for and target employs forensics experts and, you know, and video analysis and in all kinds of areas. And so Target quickly became a leader in this field, and Target began training police, federal law enforcement officials, and even law enforcement agencies overseas internationally. So Target quickly became a leader in the field of forensics, but also in the field of surveillance. And so by opening up its forensics labs to law enforcement, Target was able to become a frequent partner and collaborator with police and feds across the country in cracking crime and trying to solve cases. And we're talking about beyond shoplifting, right? So Target, more than 25% of the work that gets done in its crime labs have nothing to do with shoplifting, have nothing to do with Target stores.
That's the voice of a freelance journalist from Unicorn Riot. His name is MJ Sadar, and we're talking to him about the 12-part series that he did on the Target Corporation. It was something that was written before there were calls to boycott Target for eliminating DEI policies. I think the thing that stands out for me is that while Target was doing these DEI policies and celebrating LGBT month and Black History Month and all that, from your report, they were really working vehemently against the interests of Black folks, Black youth in particular. I want to come back to the surveillance thing, because they were gung-ho in this, especially with facial recognition technology, and it raises a lot of questions that you bring up in your report, in your series. I guess the one thing is, if I read everything correctly, was that getting the police to have facial recognition technology was going to be a long road to climb, but Target could do it and did do it. And then alongside that, we start to see, and I think you alluded to that they were funding the campaigns and pretty much, in my opinion, owned the district attorney, as you mentioned, funding the police. And also part of a larger narrative, which I think is important, is eradicating or helping get rid of undesirable populations, quotations around the word undesirable, to bring in new residents into the city. And you talked about the housing boom and what's going on in Minneapolis, and Target has been front and center in that. So there's a lot of things. I mean, on one hand, it's like, yay, they got a Black retailer and they have Black displays, but everything they're doing off record is anti-Black to the core, is what I gathered. Did I misunderstand this in your reports?
No, you're right on. You're right on. And so in the early 2000s, Target began funding the county attorney's office. And what they did was they wanted our prosecutors to go after some of the lowest level offenders in downtown Minneapolis, as you said, because they wanted to attract a certain population to the downtown core. And these were, you know, what they call young corporate professionals, which really is suburban educated white folks to come work for these Fortune 500 companies, as we often see.
We used to call them yuppies back in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing now. Hipsters, then they became hipsters, and now there's something else.
Right.
Yeah,
and that's who, that's who targets base is, right? Its base is suburban white folks. And so in order to attract this population to move downtown and to work at Target's global headquarters in downtown Minneapolis, they employed our police force and our prosecutors to so-called clean up downtown, right? To mostly go after street populations. So we're talking about Black youths, we're talking about homeless populations. And again, it was to target some of the lowest level offenders. Downtown Minneapolis, it must be said that our downtown is one of the safest neighborhoods in the city, probably the second or third safest. Low crime, most of the crime that happens in downtown is theft, right? Because it's our central business district, but very low violent crime. And so what they did was paid for a prosecuting attorney and a paralegal to specifically go after offenders that were committing really these weren't even really crimes. They were violations. They were ordinances. Things like jaywalking, littering, drinking in public, stuff like that, urinating in public, stuff that you would typically get a citation for. And so what Target did was they started, calling for zero tolerance prosecution and sending a lot of these folks to jail. And so around the same time, they donated a surveillance camera system to the downtown district, to the city of Minneapolis, to help law enforcement and to help prosecutors catch these offenders, to make it easier to prosecute folks that were committing what they call livability crimes, right? And so livability crime, again, it's really a non-crime. It's graffiti, right? Graffiti on the wall, things that they claim were making downtown unlivable or less desirable.
Right. Well, they used to call it the broken window theory.
That's right.
And the way that was supposed to work is if I catch you doing something small, we already have a paper trail. When you do something big, so it's not one, your first offense when you do something big, because we got you on all these little things. And if I make things hot and uncomfortable with just picking out these small crimes, it's going to be a deterrent and you're going to go away. And I'm sure Target might claim that it's because of this broken window theory they put into action that your downtown is safe, one of the safer ones in this country, versus some other areas. There might be somebody sitting here in Oakland, if I was to read the next door platforms, that would say we need more Targets.
Right.
We need more of that in our city, downtown San Francisco. We need more of that. And so when you hear, how do we kind of unpack some of that? Because it sounds good on the surface, but to me, it's pretty nefarious in ways that they come to that conclusion and execute the type of things that you have described so eloquently in the series.
Right. And so broken windows, people, your listeners need to know that broken windows has been debunked as racist, right, to its core. And so broken windows is a theory that was created by law enforcement experts that said that, if law enforcement focuses on the most minor crimes, it could prevent some of the greater violent crimes. It could prevent atrocities. And this has never been proven to be true, right? And so this Safe City initiative that was created by Target, which is their hallmark mass surveillance project, was rooted in the broken windows theory, right? So if we can go after, winos and drug users on the street, people who need support, right? People who need services, people who need rehabilitation, not incarceration. But if we go after those folks, we can reduce the violent crime or prevent the violent crime from happening. And so they created a massive network of law enforcement, of private security guards, of social service workers, of business leaders, to surveil and track, you know, these downtown populations, these so-called undesirable populations, to really push them out, drive them out of the downtown, and move homelessness to other parts of the city. And so what we ended up seeing over the course of that decade from, you know, 2000 to 2010 was the creation of a program that they called the Downtown 100. And so the Downtown 100, on its face, it was an offenders list of the top 100, you know, so-called criminals in downtown Minneapolis, some of the most people who had who had racked up the most offenses. That's, you know, that was the program on its face, and it was to target these individuals and to reduce recidivism and to funnel them either to jail or to divert them to social services, because they knew most of these folks were homeless folks, right? And so again, on its face, that's what the program was. It had some what we would acknowledge were admirable goals, right? To get some of these folks housed, to get some of these folks in treatment. Well, again, as we peel back some of the layers, what we saw was that wasn't the case at all. And this program, it really became a feeder program from the streets to prison, again, for vulnerable populations, people who needed support, who needed services. And, you know, its record of housing these people and getting people into treatment successfully was very low. There was not very much, and still is not very much affordable housing for people anywhere, but especially people coming out of homelessness. And so this list, the Downtown 100 list, actually was not a list of the top 100 offenders. What it was it was a list of people who had the most contacts with police. And that's a big difference, right? Because again, many listeners at home are like, okay, you know, locking up the top 100 offenders isn't a bad thing, people might say to themselves. But as we examine this program and what was really going on, these were young people who had police contact, meaning that police had the discretion to target and to harass folks. And what police would do was they were tracking, they had a system to track, you know, who they were coming in contact with, even though they weren't arresting or citating, giving citations to these folks, right?
And so that sounds like, not to interrupt, that sounds like if we were to look at New York City's policy or the policy they had, I believe, in Pittsburgh, which was stop and frisk. Well, that 90% of the stop and frisk was concentrated in a few areas. And I mean, we're talking about thousands of people being stopped, or thousands of stops being made. People would often get stopped multiple times in these stop and frisk things. And yet, at the end of the day, it yielded less than 10% weapons and drugs or whatever it was that they were looking for. But if we go by that, there were stories of, you know, husbands and wives and kids being stopped sometimes 5-6 times by police, which would put them on that thing. So you never got arrested, but you had contact. Would that have been kind of similar? I don't know if Minneapolis or the Twin Cities had a stop and frisk type of thing, but when you talk about contact, I would imagine that would be part of that record. Like, yeah, we contacted Dave and we contacted him again and we contacted him 3 more times. We didn't find nothing, but he has 6 contacts with police, which obviously, as you point out, seem to be something that is weaponized.
Yep, and you're exactly right. Minneapolis, just like New York and Pittsburgh and some of the other major metropolitans, Our police force also use stop and frisk as a tool to target and to harass so-called undesirable populations. And we're talking about a hyper-focus on Black youth, street youth, right? And so stop and frisk is, it's a surveillance tool, right? So we're talking about layers to the surveillance. So there was surveillance technology in the form of cameras, walkie-talkies that network police, private security guards, social service workers. You had the human surveillance, right? You had snitches, police informants, folks, business partners who kept a watchful eye out on downtown. All of this information was being funneled to the police and to the prosecutor's office, which again was controlled by Target, right? And so, stop and frisk is an important part of this story of what was happening because, they were targeting young men that I worked with, right? So at the time, when a lot of this was going down, I was actually working for a downtown nonprofit, and we were providing services to homeless youth, right? I was a case manager. I ran a young Black men's group, and so in our weekly group, let me let y'all know that we created this young Black men's group because the Black youth that I work with asked for a place, a safe place to come talk about the harassment by cops and the racism that they were experiencing in downtown Minneapolis as they left the shelters in the morning and were, basically put on the streets to walk the streets all day until shelters opened back up at night, right? It was a daytime drop-in center where they could come, they could take showers, they can get meals, and they could get counseling. And so I would hear these stories of these young men being harassed by the police, being threatened by the police, being searched for no reason at all, just for being, just for frequenting downtown and being, caught on these surveillance cameras and becoming known to a lot of these businesses, especially Target. And I'm not going to say, these young men, they never admitted that they were angels. They were homeless, So much of the things they were doing that got them in trouble was shoplifting. They, many of them were committing what we call crimes of survival, right? They, selling drugs, smoking weed, drinking in public. But again, very, very little violent crime, right? Theft, stealing phones from folks. And the problem with this narrative is not all of the young people that I work with, not all of the young people downtown were involved in this, right? There were some, but the police used that to really sweep the street population in a massive dragnet, a surveillance dragnet, to really target all of them and say that these folks are making it unsafe and making it unpleasant for people to work and shop in downtown Minneapolis.
Right. MJ Sadar is our guest this afternoon, talking about the work that he's done in a 12-part series called 21st Century Jim Crow in North Star City. You can read it on Unicorn Ride, talking about the Target Corporation, and much of what he's talking about predates the call to boycott Target because of them removing DEI policies. One of the most fascinating chapters that I read in the series involved the clothing of Target stores, and for me it seemed like a vindication. We've had Target here close a couple of their stores, and immediately those closures were weaponized, not only weaponized, but they were broadcast all around the world. Oakland has more closures, and the narrative is that it's just too much crime. And I thought to myself, well, wait a second. The stores that closed were the Target stores that were made for these young urban professionals. that were supposed to move in these fancy buildings. The fancy buildings that I saw in your article seem pretty similar to the fancy buildings that they built here in Oakland, right? With the same goals in mind. And when I first heard about these store closings in other areas, they said there just wasn't enough traffic, you know, that people were like, why should I go to a small Target in my building when I can go to the big Target, you know, down the street? The big Targets haven't closed, but these small ones did. But the headline was theft and yada, yada, yada. And then you pulled up the data and you was like, nah, the math ain't mathing, as they like to say. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think also embedded in that article was the fact of what perception means to people. And so the perception here was that crime is out of control. We see these videos, we hear the stories, and, you know, and they recalled the mayor and they recalled the prosecutor in two cities. It's talking about they're not tough on crime, and with retailers saying, yeah, things are just not right, when there's a much, much bigger story at hand. So I'll let you take the floor on that, MJ.
There is a much bigger story at hand. And so here in Minneapolis, Target also opened up one of those little, you know, kind of those urban boutique, smaller versions of Target in Uptown. And Uptown is a, you know, it's kind of a trendy community. It's been gentrified over the years. And it's kind of a Minneapolis's hipster community. And so, you know, they ended up shuttering that store, I think, year before last, and it was due to foot traffic. It just wasn't making the sales that they had hoped and anticipated. And also, folks, I'm sure, you know, Target customers know, these stores weren't cheap, right? Target originally came onto the scene as a discount retailer, and over the course of the last decade or two, prices at Target have gone up, and especially at these little boutique stores. So people, you know, living in these communities realize they can get these stuff, the goods that are offered at these little boutique Targets for cheaper at other places, right? Mm-hmm. And so at the same time, what we saw, you know, during around the time of the murder of George Floyd and the pandemic, we saw Target claiming a huge uptick in shrink or in theft, right? Huge, and their numbers, you know, were quite incredible. Like you said, the math was not math. Then, you know, Target claims in 1 year, theft doubled from, you know, under a half billion to almost $1 billion just in 12 months, right? And every year it kept going up. Target executives are claiming that, you know, it's on track to shoot up more than $1 billion.
Let me hold you right there, MJ. Mm-hmm. So the one report that we did a show on this, they talked about $93 billion worth of retail theft. And we've seen a network, and I'm sure Minneapolis and St. Paul have a similar thing, of these crime narrative video sites that have popped up, you know, Oakland State of Mind, LA Unlocked, all these things, and they show, you know, mostly black people running into stores like a Target, doing a smash and grab, and they're all masked up, and mm-hmm. we've all seen the videos that have been circulating around. Oh, by the way, a lot of those videos in one city would have Oakland on it, until you go to another city and you see the same exact video and it has Houston on it. Then you go from Houston to Atlanta, have Atlanta on it, and we've had people that were from these different cities to talk about it and compare notes. But I want to come back to this $93 billion figure. And you talked about with Target alone, they're talking about a billion, half a billion, et cetera, et cetera. Most of what we've seen are people going in and grabbing things that are now locked up. Soap powder, toothbrushes, things like that. So if I go to Target the other day, you know, you might see, you know, all these toiletry items locked up. You talked about just alone a half a billion dollars. That's a hell of a lot of toothpaste that you got to be stealing. I mean,
over $1 billion now.
Over $1 billion. So
just Target stores.
Right. So that would be a stream of traffic of people walking in with bags and walking straight out, because a lot of businesses don't even make that much money. If we're talking about, you know, you'd have to have long lines and consistent stream of traffic with everybody just buying a lot of things. And it's going to be more than toiletries, right? So if you're in Target, you're buying, you know, furniture, you know, back to school stuff. There's a lot of things. But we're seeing, you know, Joe, you know, with his disheveled self walking in there with a plastic bag and coming out with some soap powder and some toiletries that then, you know, often get sold on the street corner somewhere. That ain't $1 billion worth of stuff. So this right. seems to be either something else is going on, like entire warehouses are being robbed, which becomes a whole other story. Or, as you said, a lot of inflation with people going, look, that guy, you know, who stole those toothbrushes, he's caused $1 billion in theft.
Right. You know, so let's break down these numbers a little bit. So as you said, $93 billion number, that represents all of theft across the country and in all retail outlets. So for Target to claim more than $1 billion alone, they're claiming more than 1% of all retail theft happens in Target stores. So if we take $1 billion, we divide it by 2,000 Target stores, that amounts to $500,000 in theft a year per store. And if we break that down per day, that's over $1,400 per day per store that's happening. It's an incredible number, right? And so what we realize is
with a store that has this top-notch surveillance and top of the line crime labs, right? And so we can't forget that part.
That's right. That's exactly why it's such an incredible statistic that Target is putting out here, because Target has state-of-the-art surveillance. They have their surveillance is more sophisticated than your local law enforcement technology, right? And they work closely with law enforcement. So nobody's walking out of Target with felony level goods. If anything, what Target does is they will track you. So if you go into Target, you steal some deodorant, some toothpaste, they're going to tally that. And when you come back and you steal more stuff and it amounts to a felony level case, that's when they're going to stop you and that's when they're going to arrest you. So Target lets people steal small items from its stores until it amounts to a felony level case, and that's when it works with prosecutors and police. In Target, they do the in-house investigative work. They build the case, and then they hand off that case to police and prosecutors when it reaches a felony level. So you know, for Target to claim it's losing $500,000, more than $500,000 per store per year, it's an insane amount of theft, and it's not credible, considering Target's sophisticated surveillance tracking systems. Target has what they call graze trackers hidden inside their shelves. So if you stand in front of a shelf too long, it flags a shopper as somebody who could be potentially stealing, right? And it alerts security forces inside the store, and they start monitoring you, right? And actually, not just inside the store. Target has dozens of investigative centers across the country. So they might have somebody in Cincinnati, Ohio, monitoring Oakland Target store, right? So Target's surveillance technology is super sophisticated, right? They boast it in the media how Target can, they could read the credit card numbers on your credit card at checkout through their surveillance camera, right? They can read the time on your watch through their surveillance camera. So Target, they have files on you, they have files on your children who you take inside their store. So for them to say that, you know, all of this crime is happening, what we realize is they're creating a crime panic, right? And they're doing it. It appears that Target is laundering this data right at the time where we saw their sales going down, right at the time where we saw certain stuff that's sitting on the shelves not selling, right? And so shrink, what people should know is shrink is a number, and retailers use that to push a crime narrative to say, you know, we're losing all this merchandise to theft. But shrink also includes merchandise that is damaged in stores due to whatever reason. It could be employees breaking stuff. That number also includes theft by employees, right? And so what we've learned as we unpack these numbers, most theft across the country, not just in Target, but in all retailers, is done by employees. And if we're going to go even deeper, there's more wage theft happening. So there's more theft occurring by the retailers themselves, stealing wages from their staff, which exceeds that $93 billion in shoplifting. So wage theft is actually the biggest form of theft. If we take shoplifting, if we take robberies on the street, all of that combined, it doesn't even amount to the dollars that corporations are stealing from their employees, right? But I one thing I just want to add is I could show you an article from 20 years ago where Target was, they were talking about organized crime rings coming in and stealing stuff from their stores across the country. So for more than 20 years, Target has really been manipulating this crime panic, this narrative, trying to blame a lot of this on organized crime rings. So they jump from your petty theft by homeless population stealing deodorant, toothpaste, to organized crime rings who are coming in and stealing mass amounts of stuff and then going and selling it in flea markets. And so it's a convenient narrative that keeps, you know, keeps people focused on petty crime and street crime and organized crime, and it distracts people from really scrutinizing what these retailers are really doing.
MJ, in this 12-part series, Jim Crow in North Star City, 21st Century Jim Crow, you detail that this surveillance system is not just limited to Target, right? That there's a network. So, in other words, if I walk into the Target that's down here in Emeryville, where I'm at, and I go and steal, or someplace in Minneapolis, we'll use your city, and I go, you know, up the road or walk down the street or whatever, they have a series of cameras that is able to, like, well, Dave left here, he went over here, he went down the street, he went over here. So not only are they tracking you if you keep coming back to the store, you know, they have this line of sight, so to speak, that they can be, yeah, we saw him get into his gray car, and here's the license plate, because we got top-of-the-line security.
Right.
And so, in other words, you're not really going to be able to get away unless, as you pointed out, I'm letting you get away. You know, that I'm letting you get to a point where we can have a solid case and then we can put you away for long periods of time, which then comes down to this other question. Since they have backed the campaigns and have an office, you know, tough on crime prosecutors and all these other things, how many people have they put away, and are they still claiming $1 billion worth of theft, or at least in the Twin Cities, $1 million worth of theft? Because you got all the pieces in place. You got the surveillance, you got the police, you got the tough on crime prosecutor. So is this still an issue?
Right. And you're absolutely right. So Target surveillance goes beyond its stores, right? So yes. In Minneapolis and downtown.
And that's what caught me in your report, was that you were showing this. Like, they're big brother.
That's right. And so they created a program that started in Minneapolis, in downtown Minneapolis. They called it Safe Zone. But it expanded to more than 25 cities within a year. It was in more than a dozen cities, and within a few years it was in more than two dozen cities. And so in Minneapolis, it started with a sophisticated network of surveillance cameras to monitor the downtown district where Target's global headquarters are located. In other cities, it might be surveillance cameras, or it might be other sophisticated technology that Target donated to its local law enforcement. But what we saw was in the early 2000s, Target wanted to expand its business model. Prior to, you know, 9/11, most Targets were in suburbs across America or in rural parts, right? And so they wanted to expand its market into the urban core, into the urban center. But in order for Target to do that, they made deals with local municipalities, such as Minneapolis, that in order for us to expand our stores into your city, into the urban parts of your city, we need tough on crime initiatives. So they made these deals with local police and prosecutors. And part of that exchange was Target donating equipment to municipalities, to law enforcement, to go after some of the lowest level offenders. We're not talking about murderers or violent criminals. It was targeted, or even
crime families that are supposed to be at the core of stealing all this stuff.
That's right.
You know, your proverbial mafias that we would watch on TV, or, you know, cartels, and, you know, that's fascinating, but those would be your organized crime syndicate. So guess, you know, that's high level.
That's right. And in my reports, I got direct quotes from Target executives and from local law enforcement who are basically acknowledging that it was never really about public safety. It was more about the appearance of safety, right? There's a quote from a Target report where they're talking about the ick factor of how they conducted focus groups and surveys with downtown businesses and downtown people that work downtown, and a lot of the folks that they surveyed were talking about you know, street populations that made them uncomfortable. These weren't people who were saying that they were victimized by crime or by criminals. These were people who worked downtown who were just uncomfortable seeing panhandlers on the street. They were uncomfortable seeing Black youth roaming the streets. And so this mass surveillance project that became known as Safe City, it was about going after nuisance violations, right? So I had mentioned, you know, how I work with a lot of the young people that were on the Downtown 100 list. These young men were telling me that they were being arrested for spitting on the ground, you know, for littering, right? And so these young men who were on the Downtown 100 list, that list was funneled into another list, which was known as the geographic restriction list. And so this is where the name of my report comes from. The name of my report, 21st Century Jim Crow in the North Star City, was really named after this geographic restriction list. And what a geographic restriction is basically Target was pushing to banish the so-called top offenders in downtown Minneapolis from being downtown. And they sold it to the public as diversion, right? So instead of locking you up, instead of throwing you in jail, we're just gonna trespass you from being downtown for 1 year, right? And by doing that, you know, we're reducing recidivism, we're saving someone from going to jail, and they sold it as a win-win. Now, again, as we start to unpack that more, you see that some of these people were on this list not because of the crimes they committed, but because of police harassment. Because once police see them downtown, they began to monitor them.
You're on the list not because of arrest, but because of police contact.
That's right. And so I work with a young man. He was 16. He was the number one offender on the Downtown 100 list. And he was a sweet kid. He did a lot of dumb stuff. You know, he stole and stuff. He wasn't a violent kid at all. But I remember talking to some of my colleagues, like, how did this kid become the number one offender in downtown Minneapolis? It made no sense. It was absurd. And the worst, you know, crimes he committed were stealing. And so what we saw was a corporation that purchased services from the prosecutors and from the police department to go after the people that they wanted to go after. There's a quote from a Target executive talking about how, you know, how their ideal shoppers were a woman, a suburban woman and children, and how they wanted to make, you know, their environment more like a Disney World and less like a flea market, right? So mm-hmm. if we read between the lines, they're saying the quiet part out loud. What they're saying is, you know, they wanted to suburbanize these urban cores, and they wanted to make them friendly and open them up to its white shopper base, right?
Let me ask you this as we close out, MJ. We started off by talking about Target getting rid of its diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. And so when I go into Target this Black History Month, I ain't going to see the displays. Women's History Month, no displays. June, LGBT Month, no displays, all that sort of stuff. But did they get rid of their DEI policies when it comes to surveillance and the targeting of Black youth? Did they open that up and start looking at everybody and make this colorblind and follow the ethos that is being being mentioned? I mean, I ask that sort of facetious, you know, tongue in cheek, but I'm also pretty serious, because their policy outside of retail is race based, and they have an entire business that's centered around this. You know, they're in law enforcement as much as they're into retail Target. So did they diversify on that end?
You know, you're making a really great point, Davey, and what I name in my reporting is Target's mass surveillance project. It's a racialized surveillance project, mm-hmm. and at its core is they're targeting Black folks, Black youth particularly, and this is not just in Minneapolis. When we look at some of the safe cities on the list, there are cities like Baltimore, Flint, Michigan, Washington, D.C., Compton, California, Atlanta, Georgia, and as you hear the name of these cities, we think about, wow, you know, what do these cities have in common, right? They have majority Black populations, and again, not every city on the Safe City program are majority Black cities. Like Minneapolis certainly is not a Black city, right? But when we look at what they're doing in Minneapolis, we see the hyper focus on Black youth, on Black street populations, right? And you know, before we close out, I just want to share. So I talked to a Target insider who had access to Target's CEO at the time, who was Robert Ulrich. Robert Ulrich was he was Dayton's, the president of the Dayton's Corporation, which Target was under its umbrella. So Target was founded by the Dayton's department store, the Dayton's family, in around 2000, 2001, you know, Dayton's and a lot of these big chain retail department stores started to go under, and Target, the discount retailer, became the head of the corporation. So Target was incorporated around 2000, and it became the center of this franchise, this, you know, franchise going back almost 100 years. And so Robert Ulrich, the CEO, who was head of Dayton's, became the CEO of Target Corporation. He was the one who facilitated the whole Safe City, Safe Zone surveillance project, and its surveillance partnership with police and prosecutors. And so this person that I interviewed, who was close to Robert Ulrich and other folks within Target leadership, told me that Robert Ulrich was a staunch racist, that he was known within Target's leadership for casually using the N-word
Wow.
About black men hanging out downtown outside of its Target stores. And they told me very matter-of-factly that Ulrich, his partnership, his closeness with police and prosecutors really helped in his racism and his politics, his right-wing politics, really helped shape the policies of this surveillance program. And so he made a comment that this person never forgot. They said that he was a big advocate of bringing back the death penalty. The death penalty was abolished in Minnesota, just like in most states, you know, over 100 years ago. But he wanted to bring back the death penalty. And he was quoted saying that, he said, "I don't just want to bring back the electric chair. I want to bring back the electric couch." And I scratched my head and I asked this person, I said, "Who is he talking about?" And again, we can read between the lines, right? He's complaining about black men hanging out outside of the downtown stores. He refers to black people as the N-word. So to answer your point, this whole program, Target's surveillance program, was very racialized from its beginning, right? And it was a way to really, they used the terms revitalization, revitalizing urban cores, but really it was to reverse white flight, right? That took place in the 50s right. and 60s, white folks moving out to the suburbs. They wanted to reclaim these inner cores for white populations and push poor folks and black folks out to the suburbs, to the exurbs, and to deconcentrate communities of color that they deemed the problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, MJ Sadar, our guest, freelance journalist, teacher in Minneapolis, the Twin Cities, want to thank you for joining us this afternoon. The 12-part series, 21st Century Jim Crow in North Star City, published by Unicorn Riot, is very detailed, have, you know, all the receipts, as we like to say, that is needed for people who's like, "Nah, he's exaggerating." Well, go read the article, and you know, it's not many of them are not just, you know, one and done type of things. Got to go back and you can look it up and follow the trail. How do you want people to get a hold of you? Do you and one last question. If Target is doing this, I would imagine, and I know that we don't have a lot of time, other big retailers like your Walmarts and others, do you speculate they kind of have the same dance?
You know, a lot of the practices, you know, the Target, we see Target using is being used by most retailers, you know, the massive collection of data on its customers, but none of them have the technology as sophisticated as Target. Target is really top tier. They're on a level of their own. And mm-hmm. most of these retailers do not have the partnerships with law enforcement and prosecutors that Target does. We don't see Walmart funding your local prosecutor's office or your local city attorney's office. So Target really is on a whole nother level.
And when you say funding, you're talking about like, here's some equipment, here's some resources, which is very different than funding a campaign.
That's right. Yeah. They're providing free training for law enforcement. They were actually funding, paying for prosecutors in the city account, the county attorney's office and the city attorney's office. So again, you know, Target is setting the parameters for local law enforcement here in Minneapolis, and I suspect they're doing it in other cities as well. But as far as reaching out to me, I'm on Twitter. People can find me. My handle is the People Power Podcast on Twitter. You could check out my reporting at www.unicornriot.ninja. I'm on Instagram as well. I'm not as active on Instagram. My handle on Instagram is at PopsMC, PopsEmcee. And thank you so much, Davey, for having me on your show and facilitating this conversation.
Hard knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Dadaman, Chris Juwan Cam. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out, Anita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though.
Oakland, stand up.
Stand up.
Ensemble, Meek Now Wolves.
Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on. Check out.
Why every obvious think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost or the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till they ready from the steel crate. Beef say, please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say, you beast and their lovers are named.
Real Talk Radio. You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast. Dance
to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO.